This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. If you enjoy this MPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app.
On Friday, the 11th of November, the Boho Cafe in Awapuni once again played host to the River Stop Stories event, a local history event focused on the history of Awapuni. This time, Margaret Tennant, a local historian of note, was there to talk about local history, and of course, the event also doubled as Boho's birthday. Manawatu People's Radio was there to assist with sound and also recorded the event. Here's the formal portion.
Good afternoon. Tēnā koutou katoa, nau mai, haere mai, and welcome. Welcome to our little river stop afternoon. Quite a bit has happened since we met last year, although you mightn't be aware of it all. There's been some fruit trees planted around in their corner plots here. We didn't say much about it because we didn't want them uprooted. But we're hoping that they grow. So just, you know, if you see them there, look after them and talk to them. We had a very successful St Matthew's plant fair in September. And due to the fabulous weather, brought everybody out and doubled the number of visitors to our wonderful little library around the corner. Last weekend, there was a lot of people having fun in Raleigh Street Park. And you will have noticed that the signs that tell us about Awapuni as you go through have been corrected. But unfortunately, not much else has happened to slow the traffic. In fact, nothing has happened to slow the traffic. We had hoped to be able to unveil a community defibrillator today, but unfortunately, with supply problems, it hasn't arrived yet. And we're still waiting for it. So let me just start with a few little thanks. Firstly, I'd like to thank City Council for their support of the afternoon today and support in other ways, such as the planting. And to Janine, who will talk to us in a few minutes later on, for hosting this event. For our great library branch, for their support in terms of publicity and assistance. And for the Manawatu People's Radio for providing the sound for us this afternoon and their support. And to Robert for his musical accompaniment today. Lovely to have you here. I should have said at the beginning who I am, and I'm David Chappell, and I'm one of the little group who try and engender some community spirit in Awapuni, and it's lovely to have you here this afternoon. And of course, thank you and a special welcome to our speaker this afternoon, Margaret Tennant. Margaret was formerly, the Professor of History at Massey and is now an honorary research professor within the School of Humanities. She also holds emeritus status at Massey. Margaret has special expertise in the history of social policy and the history of the non-profit sector. She has edited and co-edited a number of books covering women's history and the history of social policy. In addition, she has published more than 60 books, articles, and reports. She was recently part of the team producing City at the Centre, which was the history of Palmerston North. Margaret is involved in a number of heritage organisations, including the Heritage Trust, and I know her as an integral part of Historic Places Manawatu Horowhenua. Margaret was awarded a Civic Award in 2021. She has researched the history of Awapuni Home, which of course was the group of buildings now part of the Rangitāne Marae. So this talk is part one of two parts, because next year we hope to have a function built around the Marae that will complete the sort of history, if you like, of that group of buildings down the end of the road in Maxwell's Line. So I'm delighted to introduce to you Margaret Tennant, who's going to talk to us about those buildings down there. Please give her a warm welcome. Even get a musical introduction.
That's nice. Kia ora koutou. Thank you, David. So I was pleased to hear what the plans are for next year, because what I'm mainly going to be talking about is the Pākehā history of the site that was the Awapuni home. David's already alluded to what the Awapuni home was, but for those of you who don't know, it was a residential home for the elderly run by what was then the Palmerston North Hospital Board. It opened in 1915 and closed at the end of 1989. So where was it? It was the end of Maxwell's Line, now the site of Te Hutu Manawatu or Rangitāne or Manawatu Marae, and now associated with their health services. So it was always a core site for Rangitāne, with Wahi Tapu associated with it. But this part of their reserves was sold off in the late 19th century as Rangitāne came under increasing economic pressure. It came under the Kairanga County Council, which donated the land to the Palmerston North Hospital Board for an old men's home, when the need for such a facility was touted from around about 1908, 1911. The council also leased another 10 acres to the board at a generous rate, meaning that the home also had its own land for food production, so a little farmlet was attached to it. So the question then is, why did it come about? And here we have what was sometimes called the old man problem, which may have taken various forms, but it took a particular form at the end of the 19th century. You'll notice I might have mentioned the term old men's home, because that's what it was usually called in the first part of the 20th century. Today, something like 80% of the residents of care homes are women. A century or more ago, the proportions were pretty much reversed. As a result of the patterns of Pākehā migration, which saw more single men than women among the settler population, in the late 1860s, those aged over 65 made up 0.86%, less than 1%, of the population of Aotearoa New Zealand. By the late 1890s, it was more like 5%, or certainly by 1911, it was 5%. There was quite a percentage of those increase of those who were in the old age group, which was usually, some of us may raise our eyebrows, but which usually counted as being those aged over 65. I'll come back to that particular statistic later on. It used to be so far away, but now I'm afraid not. So a significant proportion of this elderly male population by the end of the century were in pretty poor shape. Many of them had never married. Many of them had been itinerant throughout their lives. They'd lived a life of hard physical labour, and quite a high proportion, judging by institutional statistics, were alcoholics. In the borough of Palmerston North by 1900, there were actually slightly more women than men, and this was more typical of urban centres than rural. But men predominated among the so-called destitute elderly. So what happened to them when they were no longer able to earn a living? In Palmerston North, the Hospital and Charitable Aid Board, as it was then called, paid to keep some of these derelicts, and this is the term you find in the newspaper quite a bit, in boarding houses. Here they remained all too visible in the community. loitering in the streets and frequenting public houses. By 1908, there were calls for a retreat where, quote, those whom fortune, with whom fortune had dealt harshly might spend their declining years in reasonable comfort, the words of the Manawatu Standard. The Director General of Health was keen to see a kind of super facility for the aged of Palmerston North and Wellington and everywhere in between, who would be delivered by rail to an institution that he planned to build in Otaki. One of the pleasantest and healthiest spots in New Zealand, where medical and every other assistance will be at hand, along with, he added, judicious discipline. There were cosy descriptions how each old man might tend his own little garden in the sunny climes of Otaki after being scrubbed up and restored to health and self-respect. And I'll come back to the scrubbed up bit. But by this time, Ellen Wood, the wife of former Palmerston North Mayor and MP William Wood, had taken up the cause locally, leading an immensely successful fundraising campaign for a local facility, which then gained a fairly generous government subsidy. The tragic death in 1910 of one poor derelict, described in the newspapers as Crayfish Charlie — the crayfish was alluding to whatever was wrong with him, and I'm not quite sure what it was because he had so much wrong with him. Charles Warren, to give him his proper name, suffered from heart disease, kidney failure, dropsy and diabetes. He'd formerly been in the 70th Regiment of the Imperial Forces, but had entered into decline after those days. He and a fellow derelict dwelt in a two-room shanty in a paddock near the junction of Rangitiki Street and Boundary Road. Boundary Road is what's now Tremaine Avenue, so if you think of going up Tremaine Avenue and hitting Tremaine Avenue, that's where Crayfish Charlie and his mate hung out. He had been the subject of vagrancy charges from the police and had been turned out of other shelters, despite the best efforts of the charitable aid officer to find him suitable accommodation. The Manawatu Times graphically described how Crayfish Charlie had rotted out of life, with rats running over him. He was unable to obtain even a drink of water because the other old man was unable to help himself, let alone his mate. The scandal of Crayfish Charlie's death rocked the community once the coroner's description of the man's decayed body and filthy hovel became public. So in 1915, a brand spanking old people's home was opened, taking its first residents in February of that year, not all of whom, it appears, actually wanted to be here. There are plenty of complaints on record, or there were in the hospital board records when I had access to them when I was doing my PhD, where men were saying they'd much rather stay in the boarding house in the centre of town than go out to the country, which is what Maxwell's Line was in those days. They wanted to be in the middle of the town, not out in the country. But this was quite common with many social welfare institutions at the time, psychiatric institutions, Borstals later on and so on. You put your problematic cases out in the country where hopefully they could find work tending a farm or gardens or whatever. And they were well out of sight of the respectable townspeople. Designed by Frederick de Jersey Clare, the home was safely on the outskirts of Palmerston North then, well away from pubs, and with a farmlet of about 20 acres to provide works for those who were able to do it. There were main dormitories for each sex, with smaller side rooms for the bedridden, all rooms leading off a corridor which ran the whole length of the building. There were sitting rooms for the inmates, as they are invariably called in the records, a dining room off the administration block, and excellently equipped bathrooms, a laundry, and a kitchen fitted out with the latest appliances. It was the epitomes of 1915 hospital style. Accommodation was provided for 8 female inmates, the term used, as I said, and 22 males, as well as a housemaid, cook, wardsman, and gardener, while the matron had her own bedroom, sitting room and office. Outside was the garden and a small farm producing vegetables and milk for the institution and for the hospital. There were plans to rear pigs and poultry with the assistance of inmate labour. This didn't result in a lavish diet for the so-called inmates. A ration scale from around the time of the home's opening specifies that each inmate would be allowed precisely 1 pound of bread per day, 1.5 ounces of butter, 3/4 of a pint of milk, 3/8 of an ounce of tea, 3 ounces of sugar, and 1 pound of potatoes. Not exactly, I would have thought, a balanced diet. We assume they might have got at least some of the vegetables grown, but the produce, because it was also destined for the public hospital, they would have just got the leftovers. At the Awapuni home's official opening on 15th of April 1915, much praise was also bestowed on Mrs. Ellen Wood for her advocacy of the home. And much was also made of the need for the old pioneers who had fallen, need to care for the old pioneers who had fallen back on life's race. Still, the rules of the home didn't suggest any great high expectations of inmate behaviour. And if I can read some out. Inmates were to conduct themselves in an orderly manner and to obey the orders of the matron. They were to undertake work in the home without gratuity or reward. Each was to subject himself to a hot bath and a change of clothing on admission and was required to have a bath at least once a week. This is quite a necessary requirement after some old men elsewhere had threatened litigation to avoid having to have a bath once a week. And had to be, the Inspector General of Hospitals had to put out an order that they could be required to have a bath or be booted out. Spitting was banned in rooms except for utensils provided. Inmates were not to swear or to use obscene or profane language. They were not to bring liquor into the home or to leave the ground without permission of the matron. Any removal of food, clothing, or any other item remaining belonging to the home would result in the discharge and prosecution for theft. And research I did on some of the other institutions shows why this was a pretty standard rule, because the old men elsewhere weren't beyond nicking a few things, and including other inmates' false teeth, and going to the local pawn shop to get money for alcohol, pawning them for alcohol. By the 1920s, the rules also specified that inmates were not to gamble, create noise, nor in any way behave indecently, or to disturb or annoy any other inmate in any manner whatsoever. So prescriptions of this kind were responses to actual and anticipated misdemeanours. The home was not necessarily a place of ready compliance and gratitude for the care received. And again, this was not a specific problem with Awapuni. It was pretty common where you had men who had never really been domesticated, shall we say, having to go into an institutional setting and live alongside large numbers of others. They didn't do that very readily. And it was quite striking in many other places when I did research that the women's wards were often described as homely. The men's wards were much more grubby and problematic and disorderly. So the women were used, I think, complying to other people's needs and wishes. The men were not. So there's no lack of references in the following years to refractory or truculent inmates, and this is reported in the newspapers, to petty squabbles and occasional fisticuffs. The inmates weren't backward in making complaints about staff either, occasionally accusing them of swearing, stealing, and immorality. There were the wanderers, like the one who caught the wrong bus home from town and ended up at the Terrace End Cemetery before falling asleep on the railway line, fortunately to be discovered by a local resident and sent back to the home. There were the letter writers, like one Richard Shaw, who wrote to the Governor-General in the early years of the home, complaining about a lost, and he implied, stolen money order. But most of the letters taken up, it's quite a tragic letter because it's taken up with his multiple health issues. He claimed to have malaria, dipsomania, leprosy, Bright's disease, cancer of the gums, and a chest infection. And there's a little comment at the bottom, nonsense. This is from the hospital board secretary in a note on the bottom. The man was in the pink of health but had received a message from the Almighty telling him not to work. So, again, a sort of insight into the preoccupations and concerns of the residents and, of course, about their own health. I could give more of these examples, but what I want to do in the rest of the talk is to focus on the transition of the Awapuni home from a home intended primarily for indigent men to a form of geriatric hospital, as we might know it today. An early indication of this trajectory came from the initial appointment of a trained nurse or matron rather than a master to run the home. There was quite a lot of debate as to which way to go in the hospital board. Many homes had a master and a matron. The master was a man who was intended to run the home and to instill discipline, where his wife was the matron, basically a housekeeper. But eventually, thanks to the pressure from the women board members, Ada Kilgar, who was one of the first nurses to gain registration at Palmerston North Hospital, was appointed as a matron. So it's significant that they have a trained nurse there right from the start. And that this trained nurse also had experience as a district nurse in Christchurch. She'd also been matron of the Kumara Hospital. But as a district nurse, she also had experience in dealing with old people and their illnesses. Interestingly, she was also given leave during the war to serve on the hospital ship Mahino. So she was one of our one of the nurses who went overseas in World War I. And like most of her charges, she actually died at the home. When a staff member took the matron her early morning cup of tea on November 1922, she was found dead in bed, having apparently succumbed to a known heart condition. She was only in her early 50s at the time. But the point is that leadership of the home came under a trained female nurse, and the number of nursing staff and nursing aides soon expanded. The place also looked like a hospital right from the start and was laid out with wards like a hospital, whereas many other old people's homes of the time were really just large houses that had been used to home elderly people. But all this led to a relationship around the home's relationship with the public hospital and where to put so-called chronics or incurables, those with paralysis, TB, cancer, and other terminal conditions. Hospital doctors, who by this time saw their institution as a place of active treatment, cure, and speedy discharge, didn't want them there. But nor was the Awapuni home actually equipped to deal with the seriously ill, or to give skilled treatment and dedicated nursing care to the extent that these cases required. There was a bigger question of whether places like Awapuni were to be homes for those in their twilight years, so there's quite a lot of discourse around the institution as a home. Perhaps living there, doing a bit of work to earn their keep, or would they be hospitals where people with incurable conditions could get skilled nursing care? And if it was the latter, did you actually need to be old to go there if you had something like cancer or tuberculosis? Either way, hospital board members weren't keen on retaining these costly long-term cases, certainly not in the main hospital, and they hoped that private provision could be made for them. At the time, nobody really wanted these unfortunates. And this was part of a national debate, the Awapuni home's future direction being decided in 1936 when two new wards were opened for chronics and the name was shortened to Awapuni Home. And by the 1950s and 60s, it was known as the Awapuni Hospital. So this identifying of the place as a hospital had taken place really by the 1960s. By this time, a new generation of rest homes was emerging. In 1950, the national government introduced 50% subsidies, capital subsidies, for the building of facilities for old people, which encouraged the churches in particular to start to construct or equip their own institutions. In Palmerston North, Presbyterian Social Services opened the Brightwater Home as a newly built facility and took over the Willard Home, which had previously been a children's home. And this is an interesting thing, actually, as a sideline in the history of church social services. The churches were really into care for children in the first part of the century. As this became unpopular or not seen as good for children, many of them transformed their children's homes into homes for the elderly. So the Willard Home, which had originally been opened by the Women's Christian Temperance Union as a children's home, became a home for the elderly, which it remains, I think. Another new development was the notion of the retirement village based on American models. Churches and charitable trusts led the way nationally. Some rest homes, like the Brightwater Home, built modest residences for those able to live independently. But from the 1990s, a new generation of purpose-built, profit-driven retirement villages emerged, geared not to low-income people, but to those able to pay. Chains like Somerset, MetLife Care, I think Ryman was one of the earliest, started this kind of retirement village model, and it accelerated enormously in the 1990s. Many were and still are intended for the young old, those seeking support and company of others rather than full care through incapacity. Many of the existing trust-owned villages were taken over by commercial operators from the 1990s. The problem of the homeless elderly unable to afford to go into a retirement village, and increasingly they're unable to afford private rents. This problem still remains, and I think the disjunction, if you like, between those able to afford to buy into retirement villages and those unable to even pay private rents as seems to be increasing. So what of the Awapuni home? I wrote an article for the Manawatū Journal of History where I noted it, by the 1960s it was increasingly regarded as an earthquake risk. The Palmerston North Hospital Board drew up plans for a long-term care facility at Okautere. And what's interesting about this, they intended that this facility, again, it sort of has shades of being a bit of a dumping ground for those who they couldn't think of placing anywhere else. It was not just for the elderly, but for younger disabled people in psychiatric cases. The City Council Planning Department, interestingly, opposed the facility being located at Okautere on the grounds that the Council's long-term plan was then for expansion in the direction of Bunnythorpe, and that a facility at Okautere would be too isolated. So things have changed enormously on the planning front since then. In the end, new orthodoxies went against the idea of the large institution for old and disabled people. Community care was becoming the catch cry. And by the 1980s, the hospital board was moving away from institutional care for the elderly and promoting expanded community support services instead. And that's their current thrust, is to keep people in their own homes for as long as possible, but also to provide subsidised care in institutions usually provided by others if needed, and with due asset testing. The Awapuni home closed in 1989, and many of you will be aware of the site's subsequent history. When the Area Health Board proposed to auction the facility, Rangitane began the process of regaining this historically important site for their iwi. Through the sale of an existing property in Main Street and other fundraising, the land returned to Rangitane, with the iwi social service arm, Whakapai Hauora, basing itself there. So the health link remained, along with a range of other social and environmental services. In 2004, Tutu Palmoa was opened as the first Rangitane marae within the city boundaries, since the Kiki Whenua marae, further along and rather closer to the Mangoni stream, was burnt down with an apparent arson in 1925. The old Awapuni Hospital was the product of its time and a reflection of the needs of a particular historical constituency of need. It changed from being an old men's home, often their only home ever, into a geriatric hospital staffed by nurses and nurse aides. And it was in this stage of its life that I made my acquaintance with it. My grandfather was temporarily there in the early 1960s when his behaviour became problematic for a while. But I best remember it through visits to my grandmother on my father's side in the late 1960s. Grandma had had both legs amputated because of poor circulation after years of chronic arthritis and a broken hip, both conditions that today would be treated much more proactively than they could be at the time. There was nowhere else in the whole area that would take someone requiring her level of care. I remember visiting her in a long ward where she lay in her bed alongside dementia and other cases. In the days before incontinence products, there was a vague smell of urine which my teenage self noticed. But the sister in charge was wonderfully caring and understanding, doing her best to make Grandma comfortable. The aides, many of them young women from the city's relatively new Pacifica population, were cheery and kindly, and Grandma loved them and spoke well of the care she received. When another resident came along and started eating Grandma's flowers, Grandma gently chided the teenage me for remarking on the milady's behaviour. "I'm sick in my body," she said. "She's just sick in her mind." Grandma seemed so old at the time, but I'm chastened when I realise she was only 2 years older than I when she died at the Awapuna Hospital in 1969. Lessons in that, I think. Karma, perhaps. The old hospital was a descendant of the rather grim, benevolent institutions of the 19th century, but I think we must remember it was also a place of great humanity in many forms and of great kindness on the part of staff there. I'll leave it at that, and some other people may have their own memories or questions they want to ask about it. David.
Thank you, Margaret. Does anybody have any questions for Margaret?
Or memories?
I know we have at least one person who used to work there. Is that right? Yes? I don't know if you'd like to say anything about that. Do you have any memories or recollections?
You had to have a great sense of humour.
Yes, I'm sure you would have had. I guess to many people it was just the buildings that you went past because it was stood out there on its own, I guess. I do remember when I first came to town they'd built the, is it octagonal chapel? Which was a very fine building and still a fine building, fine space. And I remember being taken down there to have a look at this building and wondered at the whole extent of the buildings that were there. But this was a beautiful building, and the shape of it is still there and not used in the same way. But it was a nice... the hospital board at the time, I think, treated it very carefully and was very, very conscientious about it. But and they had their own architects, but... that again was something that's changed, and that all those sort of people that gave individual care to those places is gone. So, it's a difficult place. So it was in the country, and it's hard to remember that and imagine that, but some of you will know that. I know what my wife says, that when she came here, College Street stopped here or something. And so, there it was. You went out in the country to the hospital. And I think what you've highlighted is the change in all those things that have happened since then. And people seem to try and judge the people of those days on our terms, today's terms. And I don't think that's fair. As you say, there was a lot of compassion, a lot of help, and a lot of understanding for the people that were there. And it was their way of trying to solve that problem. And we solve the problems nowadays, and as you point out, there's still issues about people who can afford things and people who can't. And I'm sure the next generation will look at us and say, oh, what on earth were they doing then? Never mind. Yeah. Yes.
I worked there as a student nurse for 6 weeks in 1976,
Yes. We were bused every day out into the country to look after the residents, and I was in a women's ward, and it did have a really good feel to it, and there was insufficient staff at night, so often we'd come to a very busy ward at 7 o'clock. I remember there was really good morning and afternoon teas with the staff, and I remember gaining weight, but you got to know the folk, and yeah, it was happy times, actually, feeling that you were really contributing to hearing for often a lot of them didn't have visitors to speak
of. That's lovely, thank you. I'm sure there's a chance when we have afternoon tea for you to share anything and to make any other comments that you might like to make with them, and particularly to Margaret. Yes.
We've lived down Maxwell's Line
yes.
for 60 years.
Yes.
And it was the country when we first moved there.
Yes.
But my grandmother also ended the last few years, or few months actually, her life there. And I used to go down and wheel her back to my place quite regularly. We only had a footpath on that side of the street, not on our side of the street in those days, because it was the country. But she was put in a long ward, as you say. A ward, I would say, where people were probably a bit more senile. She was more a medical patient. And she said to my aunt one day, if you don't get me out of here, I'll be as mad as what they are. But it was known as the old people's home.
Yes.
And the hospital chapel there.
Yes.
There were often weddings in that there in those days too.
They
were used by various denominations for church services. And at one stage we used to send our stable manure down there, didn't we, for the gardens. So there you go.
Thank you.
In 1973, I was organist. I knew the organist at St David's Church, and our minister at the time, Martin Cleveland, was taking regular services on a Sunday morning about 9 a.m. in the chapel. So one morning he invited me down to be the organist there, which became a regular thing occasionally. And get out of bed early to do an early morning church service before you go to the main one in St David's. But I walked down the corridor to the chapel and I heard the organ playing. I thought, and it was very good music. It was rich. And I thought, well, what am I, you know, what am I doing here? I was totally flummoxed because I walked into the chapel. There was an organ on the side, which I was going to be playing, but pushed into it was an elderly gentleman. I found that he was a Mr. Dodds. He was pushed into the organ in a wheelchair. I don't know where he was mentally, but his hands... It was rich, and I'd heard later that he played many pipe organs around New Zealand, which at the time I did too. But it was one of those magic moments in that chapel, and the chapel's still there.
Yes, it's still there. Yes, I think it's. I think had my recollections had stained glass windows in it, and that they're not. I don't think. Don't think they're still there, are they?
Anyway, I would have Mr. Dodds play when I arrived. In future engagements until the service started, and then they would wheel him away and I would get on with the proper music that I had to read and be fully aware of.
Yeah. How lovely, thank you. Yeah. Now, is Janine here?
She's coming.
Coming. Because this, thank you, yeah. This is a special day also for... Janine and Boho, and over to you, my dear.
Oh, thank you. I don't think I need to use it. You can all hear me. I've got a big loud voice, haven't I? Can you hear me down the back? Yeah, lovely. Well, first of all, it's just so lovely to see you all here today. Last year we held our fifth birthday celebrations, and there weren't quite so many of you because I think we were impacted by COVID last year, but this year... it's just so lovely to see so many of you, and we do extend a very warm welcome to you all and thank you all for coming. Mace unfortunately can't be here today. He is working, beavering away at home, but he would normally be here. But he does also extend his welcome to you all and invite you to stay and enjoy some afternoon tea with us. This year, we're celebrating our sixth birthday, which is really quite amazing. There was a gentleman that was just down the back there that was just reminiscing with me this morning that somebody said to him, when we open, they shook their head, it'll never last. So we're delighted that we've been here for 6 years now and that we're going from strength to strength. And on that note, you're going to be the first to be able to see the new signs for down the back, where we're going to have Boho at the back. From this weekend on, we will be opening Mrs. Bo's Botanical and Curiosity Emporium, which will have, it will bring many of my loves together, flowers and all sorts of curious and interesting things. You'll be able to have your tea and coffee and your lunch down there. I'm a little bit aggressive for me to get open completely this year. There are two rooms down there that next year that will turn into being able to be used for functions, for small groups, for baby showers, you know, hens, stews. And also in winter, when we lose out the front there, we'll be able to have the overflow down the back. So do look out and come and see us. We'll be open from Saturday, so you're all invited to come down there. And just if you're reading up and you want to book down there, just remind us that it's actually down the back at Mrs. Bowes, not up in this part, and we'll be able to make a booking for you. But I guess that's... I just want to extend a big thank you to the community in Awapuni. You guys have been absolutely amazing, and there are people here that have supported us every step of the way, and they still do, and they still do all sorts of fabulous things for me. We have a group called the Riverstock Awapuni group, and that we met fairly regularly. We do interesting and fun things around here, but they're just an absolute treasure for this community, and as are you all. Mace and I and the team here are very aware of the fact that we're only here because you guys keep coming back, and that allows us to do what we love doing, which is serving you and bringing you the good times with your family, whānau and friends. So we do invite you to stay and enjoy some hospitality, and a kia ora to you all, and thank you all so much for coming.
I'd have to ask my team members what we're supposed to do now. I should point out that I can't count that well, but I think there's four or something of us, and I'm the only male, so I got the job of standing at the front. They all voted, and I, you know, it was a 3-1 vote, and here I am. Here's Bev. Bev's one of them. Interesting, one of the things we've been looking at and sorting out is some of the history around the place, and Robert was sharing with me before that the Scout Hall, which some of you will know across the road, or Guide Hall, that's across the road off College Street there, the council is looking for maybe a new use for it or what to do about it, and Robert was telling me that it was a gymnasium and an older hall down at St David's and Terrace End, and it was moved here. So that it's a little bit of history there that we didn't realise. So it's an import, so we don't really worry about that. So, Bev.
I'm Bev. I'm one of the Riverstock Awapuni, and my job is really lovely because I just get to give out the thank you gifts. And you don't really need it, but you've got one this year. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Robert's wonderful. He comes every year, plays as we...
Thank you very much.
Computer, which is what it is.
It sometimes plays even without him playing it. I heard it before.
People's radio, I'll leave it up here. It's for all of you, not just for you, okay? Pop it in here. And of course, Margaret. This is for you, if you'd like to come. I should have brought it with you.
Thank you very much.
That's me.
So that's the formalities, as formal as they are. And I see that afternoon tea is now coming out. So please mix and share and enjoy the rest of the time.
On Manawatū People's Radio Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. That was the formal portion of the River Stop Stories event for Awapuni local history, held at the Boho Cafe in Awapuni on Friday the 11th of November 2022. If you'd like to hear more recordings of events like this, you can find those as podcasts on our website at npr.nz/show/specials. Right now, we'll continue with the Sunday Live Zone. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatū, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.